All right, good morning, everyone. As usual, about 20 seconds early, but I'm generally good about giving you guys that back. Okay, so hi, I'm going to turn the lights down for a bit, and I just see if we can look at this. You can kind of, and you know what, I'm sorry, I'm really bad at this kind of stuff, but I'm amazed. I even got it turned on, and I did, so
I'm going to take advantage of it for a moment. All right. So you can kind of see here, it's not a great image, and I would have liked to have had one that was about probably 30, 40 years earlier than what we have here. But if you can tell, hey, classical Greece and the Athenian Empire, roughly about 450 BC. So as we talked about just briefly last week, and really didn't spend much time on as we started looking at the Greeks, moving away from the Jews and the Hebrews into the Greek world, we find that the Greeks themselves are, unlike, say, what the Jews desire under Saul and David, they are incredibly decentralized. They are about as radically decentralized as we can imagine any society in the world, at least roughly around 500 to 490 BC. And it's during that time period that, and I want to make sure that you read this in your book. I can't get the author's name right now. Guy from Yale, the first man on your, whatever his name is. This is terrible, I'm not remembering him. Does anyone have their textbook? You don't have to. But
Kagan,
thank you. Donald Kagan, who is the absolute, he's the greatest historian in the world on this stuff, actually. Just amazing. But I want you to read on the Persian Wars and what the Persian Wars were. And we're only going to talk today about one little part of the Persian Wars. I just introduced it very, very quickly on Friday. And the aspect of the Persian Wars that we talked about was simply that Xerxes and Darius, as the Persian god kings, were deeply offended that you could have a decentralized society, like what we see here in Greece. So if you remember, as I put on the board, this idea of a polis, P-O-L-I-S, this was the central form of community for the classical Greeks. It was everything to them. The polis was more or less like, as I mentioned on Friday, somewhat like a neighborhood association, but mixed with a church. So if you want to imagine giving all of your loyalty over to the community, this is what the polis was. And the Greeks had this idea, one that we would not recognize today very easily, but their idea of freedom was the freedom to choose one's form of government. And that seems very contradictory to us, because they may choose some kind of form of government like the Spartans do that seems absolutely abhorrent to our way of life. And yet for the Greeks, that was freedom. Even if you were born into Sparta long after it had been created, they still think of it as having the freedom to choose their form of government. And the main reason is because they don't have a god king. Because they all have a kind of base equality, and yet even among the Spartans, you were talking about 20% of the population that controls everything else. This is if we want to think about a horrific society, Sparta would be a pretty horrific society, where roughly one out of every five persons controls, four out of every five persons, and there's enslaved. Those who are not ruling are enslaved. And yet, there's still something in Sparta that we recognize as superior to Persia only because Persia was ruled by this god king, this king who claimed he had divine power as well. That's different than being told something by the divine, that is, if we go to the oracle, versus actually having the oracle rule, or having the king as oracle, or having the king as pope, or in the case of what we saw in 1 and 2 Samuel, as prophet. So we don't want to have those offices. And the Greeks are very clear about this. So out of all the Greek, again, we call it polis, there's no great definition. I'm just going to translate it into English for right now as city-state. That's not good. It's just the best that it is. When we look at these city-states, they are radically different one from another. So about 150 overall, but they could be anything from the kind of Las Vegas style of Corinth to the radical martial style of Sparta. And those two were great allies. But then you might have Thessaly or you have Athens. And there are a whole number of these towns
that each one of them represents something different. And yet, within them, they all speak Greek, and they all think of themselves as unified because of the Greek language and roughly the Greek culture. So politics means something to them, but it doesn't mean what it means to us. Now, we're so fascinated and fixated on the coming election, and, you know, did something drop out of Hillary's pant leg yesterday or whatever, and did she collapse, and why did she collapse? I mean, this was important, and it is important, but it's nothing compared to what we see here, where the things that matter most are what you're willing to give to your community. So politics is a part of life, but it's not everything in the polis. And I suppose there's a bit of a paradox in that, especially because we get the idea of polity, politics, from the idea of the polis, and yet it's very decentralized. So I want to point out here two things. First of all, I want to point out a very small town that doesn't exist anymore, but it's because it's underwater. It's this little town right here called Miletus. This is a town you have to know from today all the way to the end of the class, really to the end of your career at Hillsdale. Miletus here, which was Greek, even though it's on the Persian coast, okay, so again, it's gone now, it's underwater. In fact, it's underwater about 20 miles. This whole little peninsula is underwater at this point. It's change in, not warfare or anything, it's just change of sea levels. But it's underwater. This area right here was Greek. It would alternate between being Greek and Persian, Greek and Persian. It would go back and forth depending on who was in control of this region. So remember, there's no centralized Greece. There are lots of city-states. So the peoples there are either free, meaning they're aligning themselves with the Greeks, or they're under the heel of the oppression of the Persians. Regardless, because this town Miletus goes back and forth between the East and the West, the Occident and the Orient so perfectly, it's not totally accidental that Miletus is the one place in the entire world. This happens nowhere else. And of course, it's a birth, so it can only happen once. But this is where philosophy begins. It all begins in this little town that shifts allegiances and alliances depending on who's there. And it's a major trade center as well. So this is the port, one of the great ports. If you want to take goods from the Aegean or the Mediterranean into Persia, or you want goods from Persia into the Mediterranean, Miletus is a natural port. So it makes sense that this town, this crossroads of the East and the West, would be the place where philosophy starts. So I want you to keep that in mind for now. We're going to come back to it in a little bit. But the other thing that I want to note here, and this is the second thing that I'm going to spend a little bit more time on right now, is the fact of the Persian Wars. Persian Wars are absolutely critical for our understanding of the West, because the Persian Wars are this huge, massive region. Don't even have it all on the map here. Persia would go on quite a ways, really almost all the way to India. So this whole place that we now call the Near East, or parts of the Middle East, but not quite, Iraq, Iran, Syria, this whole area going all the way into Afghanistan, really all the way to India, this was all the Persian Empire. And it was a massive, centralized, bureaucratic, very wealthy empire. It's one of the largest empires the world has ever seen. It is ruled by a number of different figures, of course, in succession, these emperors. Some of them are quite good. We find in Persian history, in fact, some amazing people who, even though they may consider themselves god kings, they're actually really interesting philosophers as well, almost like philosopher kings, people who really have great storehouses of wisdom. But then when we get to our age, where we are here in the 400s BC and the Persian Wars, we find two rulers who are so arrogant, Xerxes and Darius. So X-E-R-X-E-S and then D-A-R-I-U-S. This is all in your textbook. But these two rulers, these Persian rulers, are so arrogant, they simply cannot abide by the fact that Greece is independent and decentralized. It is offensive to their own ideas of godhood that somehow these peoples could be free. And so they launch three major invasions against the Greeks. And those invasions, and I want you to know the dates, but we're going to talk about one of them in particular. Those invasions come in 494 BC, and remember, we're counting backwards, okay, because we're moving towards Christ. So we're counting backwards, BC, before Christ.
So we're about 494, massive invasion, 490, another massive invasion, and then 480, 479, the last major invasion. So 494, 490, and 480, and 479. As, again, I know it gets confusing because we're counting backwards, but hopefully it makes sense for everyone. So these are the four major invasions, and during that three major invasions, during that time, we have a state where they're not, if they're not at active war with one another, they're in a cold war with one another. And the cold war really begins about 500 BC. It just breaks into open warfare 6 years later in 494. So how do you deal with this? This is a very interesting question for the Greeks, because you can imagine, and if we just, we have to put this in a different perspective here, and I'm obviously being absurd for a moment, but let's imagine that Canada decided to invade all of Michigan. And I don't know how they'd do it. You know, they probably have some kind of, you know, crazy beer and some hard progressive rock and big pickup trucks, and they'd be driving over in their flannel. And so they're coming over. But as they do so, as they come across the border, if they wouldn't attack a unified Michigan, they might attack Detroit, or they might attack Flint, or they might attack Lansing or Hillsdale. And so each of us responds individually. This is what's happening when the Persians are coming over. They're not meeting a unified Greece, because there's no such thing as a unified Greece. Greece, by definition, is not unified. It is decentralized. So every time the Persians come, they come as this massive, massive military force. In the final invasion, they have 100,000 battle hardened troops coming against Greece, plus a full naval expedition launched at the same time in 480 and 479. So these are massive numbers. Yeah, and you can imagine it. Hillsdale County had to defend itself against the full weight of the Canadian Empire. Right? And again, I know I'm being absurd, but just that's what the equivalent was. Right? What are we going to do? You know, we've got this whole huge, all their resources, everything. We're this tiny little county. We're this tiny town. And that's what Athens and Sparta, that's how they perceive themselves. They're so different from the other Greeks, they don't quite know how to deal with this. And so when the god king of Persia launches the final invasion, 480, 479, he sends his men, all of them, and they're slaves. Yeah, these are conscripts. These are people who are forced into battle. Many of them have seen battle elsewhere. This is an empire. They battle all the time. They've seen battle elsewhere, but they're still being forced by whip and by spear to move, and he moves all of his men, not surprisingly, along the coastline. So as the Persian king moves his men, we've got 100,000 of them coming down through here. And you know, we don't even have a Greek city-state that has, say, more than 10,000 people total. So we've got 100,000 soldiers coming against the people that have really no centralized military. They just have what we would call militias, the equivalent of a militia. But on this last invasion, as they come through, 100,000 men, the Persians also send a huge naval fleet against Athens. So at the same time that they're sending men on land, they're sending the equivalent of the naval and the marines, the navy and the marines as well. And so these men, the Persians, come down here, and I can't identified exactly on here, but here we have Athens, and Marathon is right there. It's just a little over 24 miles away there. But right in here, as they come through, and I'm sorry you can't see this very well, is the Persians, 100,000 of them, are meeting and coming down and invading. A number of Spartans, in particular 300 of them, being led by their king, their war king, a guy by the name of Leonidas, they decide that they alone, with just a few allies, not many, they send almost everybody else home, they decide that they will fight in the name of Greece, which has not happened before. They're not just fighting for Sparta. They decide that they will fight in the name of Greece, and they will do so for glory. And part of the reason is because the oracle has prophesied that Leonidas would go down in history as this great warrior king, but not a god king, but a warrior king. And so Leonidas, with just 300 men, and then just a very few, I mean, really, really few allies, like 20 Thessalonians, stay in this region, and they hold this little pass called Thermopylae, which is also known as the Gates of Fire or the Gate of the Lion. At this little pass, it's a narrow ridge where if the Persian troops are going to have to come, they're going to get bottlenecked
right on this spot. And so the Spartans, knowing they dedicate themselves completely to the death, they know they will all die, 300 against 100,000. They know they have no chance. But what they're trying to do, which is astonishing, is they're trying to give the rest of Greece, all these disparate city-states, giving them time to get their defenses in order before this invasion makes it. Now, that's incredible to think about that. And, of course, these Spartans, they don't just dedicate themselves to each other and to honor, but they dedicate themselves to something that we would call the equivalent of almost a spiritual unity. That is, they believe that they are sacrificing themselves for something far larger than what any one of them counts for. And I will state this, and I've told you there'll be a couple of those where I throw down the gauntlet moments in this class, but I think it's very important to note that these 300 Spartans with one betrayer, they do kill themselves. They die. They throw themselves in battle. They're able to hold off the Persians for a very long time. In fact, three separate invasions. It's only on the fourth invasion that their own line collapses, and it's because one of their own had betrayed them and told the Persians how to get around the mountain pass so that the Spartans would be locked in, and they are betrayed. But you just think about what these guys do. They're holding off 100,000 Persians. It's just astonishing. So Herodotus, and here's my gauntlet moment. I'm going to read from Herodotus here. But I will argue this, that when the last Spartan dies at Thermopylae, that's where the West is born. The West, as a civilization, is born in sacrifice. And it is born with the last blood shed by the last remaining Spartan. Who, again, remember Sparta. This is not a nice place. We're not going to model, I hope, pray to God. We never model our own government after Sparta. And yet, what they do here and what Leonidas does is astounding. And it's in large part, we're going to be witnessing this. And I know at Hillsdale, and I love this, I agree with it too, that we often think of the West as liberty. And we should. But we also have to remember there has never, ever, ever, in any way, shape, or form, been liberty without sacrifice. It just does not happen. Liberty is always accompanied by bloodshed. And it's unfortunate, but it's also an empirical truth. Nobody gets liberty freely, even if God gives it to us as a natural right. We still have to be willing to die in order to claim it. And that's a paradox, of course. In order to be free, we have to be willing to give ourselves ultimately for this cause. It's an incredible paradox, and yet it's one that's been lived out by Hillsdale men, most of them, as you probably know, on the first day of the Civil War, almost 492 of the 500 men on this campus signed up to fight for Lincoln on day one, pure volunteers. Most of them died on the first day at Gettysburg, doing exactly, and this was not accidental, when they put themselves on the road in front of Gettysburg to bottleneck the Confederates, which outnumbered them 10 to 1, they intentionally modeled themselves after Leonidas at Thermopylae. And they die. They all die within about 20 minutes. If you've been up to the top of Del Paul, our whole floor up there is dedicated to the sacrifice that your fellow Hillsdale men gave on July 1st of 1863. But they do that intentionally because they're modeling themselves after Leonidas. That's why they do it on the first day of Gettysburg. And if they had not done that, of course, the Confederates would have gained the high ground very easily. It's one of those moments the whole world would have changed had they not done that. And that's exactly what happens here at Thermopylae. The entire world would be different had these 300 men made a different choice. You think about that. 300 men. The world turns on the decision of 300 men. That's incredible to think about. So here's how Herodotus, who is the great chronicler of this and the first great historian in world history, this is what he writes. Xerxes let four whole days elapse, all the while expecting that these Greeks would run away. But when on the fifth day they had still not gone away, but were instead holding their positions in what seemed to him a display of reckless impudence, he lost his temper and he ordered his best troops out against them, with instructions to bring the Greeks alive so that he could conduct them, meaning interrogate them, in his presence. Then his best men charged headlong into the Greeks, but in great numbers they fell. Although others rushed forth to replace them, even they could not drive the Greeks away, though they too suffered great losses in the attempt. Indeed, the Hellenes made it clear, the Greeks made it clear, and this is the critical sentence, and especially to the god king himself, that though there were many soldiers, he had no men. So everybody catch that, sorry, with the siren. That's kind of bad timing there. But this idea, as Xerxes looks out in this battle, 100,000 of his men cannot take 300 Spartans. And as he says, I have thousands of soldiers, but not one man. And that is crucial to understanding who and what we are. Is this scheduled? Anyone know?
I think it is.
It was scheduled. Is it tornado? Okay. Lovely. Sorry. What's that?
Air raid.
What? It is the day after 9/11, right?
Canadians.
Canadians. That's right. Canadians. They're in their trucks.
They're dropping maple syrup from the sky.
All right, I'm just going to check real quick and make sure everything's okay. Yeah, I assume we wouldn't go outside, right? That would be stupid.
I think we go downstairs. So, right?
Are we supposed to go in the basement?
Yeah, you're supposed to go in the basement or hallway.
You can see I'm really worried. All right, let's see what's going on. Okay, anyone freaking out?
63.
You guys are all right. Oh, that's right. You can see what I'm doing. I should have been okay. Yep, there we go. I think we're fine. Okay, good. So anyway, that was a bit of an anticlimax, but hopefully you get the sense of, or maybe it was cool. Maybe that was foreordained, right? So, but I want you all to realize how important this is, this moment in 480 and the sacrifice that we see at Thermopylae. And of course, it does give the Greeks time. It gives them time. And they realize that the sacrifice that the Spartans made call them to something higher. That is, they are meant to be something more than just these individual city-states. Now, unfortunately, the story from there just gets really sour because it becomes a story of hubris. Once the Greeks begin to centralize, they go the way of every other centralizing people. They turn into an empire, and then they collapse in civil war, and then they're taken over. So it's a pretty terrible story, and yet, regardless, there is this moment, it's an incredible moment, where we have just a few people, free citizens, holding themselves against an empire and defeating that empire. So no matter what happens after this, that moment, the moment of the Persian Wars and the success of the Persian Wars, really is the beginning of Greek patriotism. So here's what I want to do, and let me show you this other map, and then I'm going to take this down. I just wanted you to see what the Mediterranean world looked like. This is obviously, my times are all off here. We're now jumping forward several centuries. But you can get a sense of how integrated this whole world is around the Mediterranean. So please don't, we do this, and of course it's an artifact of history, but it's good and bad. We do this thing where, okay, it's the Jews, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans, and then the Christians. And it's almost as though we're talking about four separate peoples. But you have to remember that all of these peoples, especially once the Jews come out of the Near East and end up in what we call the Holy Land, we have this huge mixing of peoples all throughout here. And that's why, as I mentioned to you on Friday, it's probably not that weird that the Greeks here had incorporated Moses as one of their demigods, as one of their great heroes. It's not that far. There's a lot of knowledge going back and forth. And we have good evidence, as I mentioned on Friday, from Dr. Paul Ray and other scholars of this era, we have pretty good evidence that probably many of the early Greek philosophers had known of the monotheism of the Jews, and probably parts of when the Egyptians had some monotheism for a bit as well. That there was probably a strain of monotheistic thought that had come out of this area that had migrated into Greece. But much of Greece settles much of Italy. So this is why, if any of you are Sicilian, one of the most common names in Sicily is Greco, this very common last name. And, of course, it's the Greek. And they're not real Sicilians, they're the Greeks. And many of these towns in Italy and in Corsica, Sardinia, and in Sicily are settled and colonized by the Greeks as well. And then, of course, the Romans, you can see here in 117 AD, the Romans have returned the favor by taking over the Greeks. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of interaction in all of this. So I'll come back to that, but I just want you to keep that in mind. As we're thinking about this, this is a relatively small world. Not really. I mean, for them, it's obviously the world, and it's huge.
But as we look back on it, we can see that this whole sea, everything from phonetics, as we talked about our language, the basis of our language, to our ideas of trade, to the ideas of the Republic, they all originate in this glorious civilization here of the Mediterranean that lasts for a very long time. Any questions on the maps? Anything that I have up here? Otherwise, I'm going to turn the lights back on and we'll... Okay, so how does this happen? That is, how can we have a defense of these free and independent peoples against this concentrated empire? And that seems bizarre in and of itself, that we could have that kind of success from these various peoples. So I'm not going to go into details on all of this, but I'm going to give just a little bit here. What is it? How are the Greeks structured, especially around the idea of the polis? What does that mean in terms of, say, protecting your community? So I'm going to focus only on one polis. Everybody does this. And it's not necessarily fair because it means we're ignoring 149 of these city-states by focusing on Athens. But it's what we know the most about. And we often identify philosophy and many of the great things that we get from the Greeks from Athens, even though Miletus is really the foundation for a lot of this all the way across the Aegean. In Athens, if you were a male, and this is only for males, it's not for women. So here when I say men, I mean specifically not humans, but male humans. In Athens, they decided that the only way that you could be a good citizen was if you were a part of the military. But they didn't really want to force you to be a part of the military because citizenship demanded that you acquiesce to that, that you become a part of that in some way. So if you wanted to vote and take a part in Athenian political life, you had to have served in the military. There's no exception to this. And that means that every male, if they are citizens, are also soldiers. So a little bit like modern-day Sweden, and I don't know how many of you know this, is Sweden's actual real name is the Confederation Helvetica, meaning we're the Confederation of the New Greeks. So they're the only European power that's based themselves on Greek city-states. All the others have based themselves loosely on Rome and the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire. So it's a kind of an interesting little tidbit, but we should keep that in mind. So in Athens, all citizens are also soldiers, and all soldiers automatically become citizens. And the way that this developed was that the wealthy, and these are pretty well-off areas, especially Athens, and I hope you had a chance to read Pericles for today, you really get a sense of how proudful, how much pride they have in terms of being able to choose their own form of government and to choose to die for their community. It's critical to their understanding of who they are. That free will is everything. So we have a very wealthy society. There's a lot of money. But like any wealthy society, it's going to have classes. So you're going to have the rich, you're going to have the middle class, you're going to have the poor, and you're going to have all kinds of gradations within it. If you're wealthy, you almost always join the land forces, which we would loosely translate into militia. But they called them hoplites. And if you were a member of the hoplites, meaning probably Socrates was, as a young man, a very effective member of his hoplite, meaning that his local neighborhood within Athens had their own militia, and they would be a part of the Athenian militia as well. And they would train all the time. So Crito, now we're going to read the dialogue of Socrates and Crito. Crito was most likely, we don't know this for certain, but most likely Crito was Socrates' best friend, and they would have been in the militia together. They would have been hoplites together. So if you could afford it, if you came from a relatively well-off middle or upper-class family, you joined the hoplites because you could pay for your own shield and your own spear and maybe even armor. So you were expected to equip yourself. This was part of your duty as a citizen, that you would carry a spear and a shield that you would provide, and you would go into battle with these things. You were also expected to train. So I'm not going to go into great details about this, Victor Davis Hanson or Dr. Calvert or any of our other specialists on Greece, including any of the people in classics, could do this 1,000 times better than I can.
But I do want you to think about this because of how natural it is and what it's based on. The entire military strategy is based on the hand. Everything's based on the fist and the fingers. It's natural. This is how they think of the military. The military is an extension. It is the hand. It is the extension. It's not the ruler of government. It is the extension and defender of government. So as the fist goes into battle, meaning you have all the militias, all the hoplites going into battle, everything, we still use these terms sometimes in sports, but still in military, you outflank, but you do this because of your phalanx, your phalanges, right, your fingers. That's where this idea comes from. So the idea is that a community will move as a fist forward into the enemy, and then what your leader does, this is what your leader is able to see that the others cannot, he tells you which finger, which phalange to extend into the enemy and then withdraw back into the fist. So the entire military strategy is based on this. And that's, we'll see that even into the Civil War, American Civil War, you still have soldiers basing their own thought because they're classically educated. Most Americans, I don't know if you guys knew this, but when we go into battle as American revolutionaries, this is long before the Civil War, but when we go into battle as American revolutionaries against the British, who of course are our greatest allies, who do we fight with against the British? Yeah, Mary Kate.
The French.
Well, think about this. Do the English speak French? No. Those guys are pigs. Do the French speak English? No, that's a peasant language. What happens when the Americans go on the battlefield with the French? How do we speak to one another?
In Greek.
In Latin, right? We speak in Latin. All the battle orders are given in Latin. Have you ever wondered about that? That's incredible to think about that. So they're writing down orders in Latin. They're communicating in Latin on the battlefield because they can't speak to each other. So it's all Latin. And we often take that for granted, but we have to remember, up until the Civil War, the only education anybody ever received in America, there was no exception to this. If you went to school, even if you only went to school, say, when you were age 6 and 7 for 2 years, that's all the schooling you ever had, all you would have done in those 2 years, equivalent of what, kindergarten and first grade, you would have been drilled in Greek and Latin. Reading, writing, and arithmetic, that's stuff you learn at home. You don't waste public money or public time on that. At school, you learn Greek and Latin. So every one of our founding fathers was fluent in Greek and Latin by the time they were 14. That's how old they were when they went to college. In fact, to get into college for the founding generation, they had over 2 weeks of just being drilled in Greek and Latin, where they would have to translate from Latin to Greek to English, back to Latin, passages from Virgil, from St. Paul, St. John, all of these various great writers at age 14 to get into college. So this is a very, very different world. But that I bring this up now because when we think about our own ideas being very Greek or very Roman, that's what you would expect. This is what these people live and breathe. They are reading St. John in the original Greek just as they're reading Virgil in the original Latin. That's too, of course you would know both of those guys, the pagans and the Christians. They knew them all. So it shouldn't surprise us that our own understanding here of militias and so forth is very classically rooted. But again, everything is based on the hand and specifically on the extension of the fingers into battle. Now, what if you're poor? Athens is pretty democratic overall. You know, they're not going to let, yeah, obviously women aren't going to be given a vote. But if we're going to make sure all men can be citizens and citizen soldiers, what do we do with the poor men in town? It's not their fault their parents messed up and didn't raise them right. At least that's the thinking of the Athenians. We have to give a chance to the poor. So what do? This is the one publicly funded aspect of the military. You can row in the Navy. And so if you're poor, all you do is sign up for the Navy. And so you serve for 2 years in the Navy as a rower, and you're a citizen. It's not your fault your parents raised you in poverty. Right? That was their idea. You still have to have the chance to do yourself. So you can't buy your own equipment, but you can row. And this is, again, just to give us a few classical references. We don't do this at Billsdale, because you can't imagine this happening on the St. Joe, but you can imagine it very clearly at UPenn or at Yale. Crew team is nothing more than the Athenian Navy being reenacted as a sport. crew is the Athenian Navy. So when you row crew, what do? You have one leader. You have no idea where you're going if you're just one of the rowers. You rely on your team leader. And the whole idea, and this is obviously pre-modern technology, the whole goal, now think about this if you're a naval man, if you're a sailor, the whole goal is you don't even know where you're going, but you want to ram the enemy ship as severely as you can so that you crush that ship, and hopefully you'll survive, but you're a human torpedo. That's what you do in the Navy. You row as fast as you can into the enemy. Later on, the Greeks will develop what's called Greek fire, a form of napalm and other things, but we're not quite there yet. And it's actually Kagan, Donald Kagan, who you guys are reading, it was one of his students who figured out that for the Greeks to be able to go the speed that they had, they must have already, and he proved this about 20 years ago, they must have already had seats that slide on mechanisms for them to be able to go the speed that they do. So there's still, Kagan's still giving us great stuff about what we understand. But again, please keep all of that in mind. This is how you participate. So this is why when you read Pericles, you have to understand the background here. Pericles gives that famous speech in 431. So we're now a full 60 years after the Persian Wars. Okay, that's done. That would be like me speaking about my grandparents in World War II. That's the generation gap we have when Pericles is speaking. Pericles will die 2 years later in 429. But when he gives that famous funeral oration, he is defining the best of what Greek democracy, and sadly, and we've got to talk about this a little bit, imperialism, what the Greeks seem to have been fighting in the previous war, and now they seem to be fighting for in this war, but imperialism becomes linked with democracy as well. So I want you to think about that. Why is there this link? How is it, and why would we make an association between, say, freedom and imperialism? I'm not saying it has to be that way, but that's kind of how Pericles presents this. So we need to give thought to that. And what you have, and I want you to keep this in mind as well. I'm not sure if we're going to talk about Pericles today. We might wait and do that so we have the full day to talk about it, or at least a big part of the day on Wednesday. But notice what you have here with these two historians. And this is a great lesson in classics and in Western scholarship. We have Herodotus, and we have Thucydides, two first great historians. Herodotus is much, much older than Thucydides. Herodotus is around during the Persian Wars, so he would be my grandfather's age, whereas I would be the age of Thucydides in terms of where this plays out, right? Or basically, you know, I would be Herodotus, you guys would be Thucydides, if we're thinking about generational differences. So what does that mean? What's the significance of that? Well, I want you to know this about both of these two historians, because they are the first. Herodotus is fascinating. Right? And this book is one of my favorite books in the entire world. This is not in any way boring. This is the very first history book ever written. It's a classic, obviously, still one of the great books. But it is a page-turner. And I hope you got, and obviously we had the tornado sirens either adding or detracting, I'm not sure which yet. I've got this recorded. I'll be interested to go back and see how that all sounds with the tornado sirens. But regardless, Herodotus, I only read you the one paragraph, but the whole idea of defending themselves, no matter what, and the writing about how the Persian king realizes he has many, many soldiers, but no men. That's the kind of writing we see throughout all of Herodotus. He is constantly talking in this way. He's writing in this way. And what he does that I think is so beautiful and so humane is that he understands that every individual matters. It's one of the greatest recognitions of the Greeks. Not just the god king. It's not just the god king. It's everybody. We all matter. So I'm going to read to you just one other part here, which I find quite moving, though as I get older, I find more depressing too, yeah, for obvious reasons, as you'll see. But he tells us, this is at the very beginning as he tries to define the human person, and their time span's a little off, so we have to add another basically 10 years to what he's thinking about the human lifespan. But he says, all right, let's think about the life of any man. Right? So no privilege here. It's just a man. What's the life of a man? All of the days in the life of a man add up to 26,250 days. Now, he's wrong about that because of life expectancy now. It would actually be around 32,000 days. But I still want you to think about that for a moment. That's depressing, to count off your life in days. I mean, how many of you did exactly what you needed to do yesterday and you felt like you were totally fulfilled, used every minute just as wisely as possible, and you're pretty satisfied, right? It was all good. You know, you were good to one another, you were charitable, you were efficient, you didn't waste any time. Yeah, that's, when you start thinking about that, now me, you know, I just turned 49 last weekend. Okay, my days are getting short. I told one of my friends, who's 5 years older than I am, one of my closest friends, I said, that's really weird. I didn't think about being almost 50 when I was 48. Now that I'm 49, I realize this is it for me. He wrote back and he said, yes, Brad, we're all going to die very soon. Thanks, Mark. And of course, I mean, the chances of that happening are slim, right? I've probably got a good another 20, 30 years, you know, God willing. But who knows, too, right? Who knows at all? So it is, as he says, this is kind of a crapshoot. And yet, what do we do? So let me continue. All of these days in the life of a man add up to 26,250 days. And yet, any one of these days brings something so completely unlike any other that we can never actually say that one day is alike to another. Now, that's incredible as well, to think about that. And so, right away, that's the opening. That's book one of Herodotus. He's basically giving us humility. You know what? I barely know myself. I am not going to presume to know you. I can't do it. I mean, what a fool would I be? How arrogant, how conceitful would I be to presume I know you? I know you're human. I know we share in certain qualities, but you, your essence, you don't even know that. And probably on your deathbed, you're still going to be wondering about who you are and things that maybe you could have done differently. Or, you know, we're all going to wonder that. It's just life. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just life. It's what everybody does. It's what everybody thinks. So how do we get to that? So here he continues. I just love the way he writes this. You seem to be very wealthy. You may rule over a lot of people. And yet I could never answer you until you end your life or your life is ended if you are happy or not. For you see, the man who is very wealthy is no more happy or prosperous than the man who has only enough to live day to day, unless good fortune says that with him, stays with him, and he retains his fair and noble possessions right up until the moment he departs from this life, and he's still happy. For many wealthy people are unhappy, while many others who have more modest resources are quite fortunate. The man who has had great wealth but is unhappy outdoes the fortunate man in only two ways, while the fortunate man outdoes him in many ways. The former is more capable of gratifying his passions and of sustaining himself in adversity, but the fortunate man, meaning the blessed man, not necessarily the rich man, although he does not have the same ability to sustain himself in adversity or passion, avoids these anyway by the virtue of just being happy. Moreover, he who has no injury, no sickness, no painful experiences, what he does have is good children. Now, if in addition to all these things he ends his life well, too, then this is the man you're looking for he alone who dies happy can be reckoned happy. But before he dies, refrain from calling him anything except lucky. So this pretty serious wisdom here in thinking about this. Wealth is a good, sure, but if it doesn't lead to happiness, it's no good at all. It means nothing. If you're poor but you're happy, that's all that really matters in the end. You've done what you need to do. And of course, happy doesn't mean I've got all the stuff in the world, I can do anything. Happy means you can die and say, yeah, you know what, I messed up on 25% of the days I lived. But 75%, I did pretty well. That's not bad. And out of my 7 kids, 4 are really happy. 1 got divorced, and I'm worried about that one. But, you know, they'll live on. They'll do something. They'll get out of this. They're good. They're strong. My oldest is only 17. No divorces yet. But this is what you reckon. This is what matters to you. And, of course, we look at 19th century tombstones, and it'll say things like, she was a good wife, and we mock that. Well, I'm not sure there's anything better in this world than being a good wife and a good dad and a good father and a good mother. I mean, in the end, it doesn't matter how much I create. If I've done good to those who live with me, I've done good. There's something profound in that, and we see that as early as Herodotus. So Herodotus brings us humility. I'm not willing to judge you because I don't know you. I have to be willing to let you be who you are meant to be. That's what Herodotus is saying. And that's beautiful, and it's very Greek in the best sense, that we have to recognize that individualism, and yet not an individualism that's tyrannical over the group, but one that works with the group and one which the group allows the individual to flourish. But then we have Thucydides, and Thucydides is reckoned as an equal to Herodotus. So I'm going to give you Brad's viewpoint for a moment. I find Thucydides dreadfully dull and boring. And one of the reasons that I find him so boring, and just getting through his history, I find painful, frankly. Just the opposite of Herodotus. Herodotus I can't put down. It's hilarious. He's funny. He hears a story. He tells you the story. He doesn't pass judgment. Some guy claims he was walking out in the field and he met a demigod. All right, I'm not going to judge him. That seems goofy to me, but it's a good story, so I'm going to write it down. Thucydides does just the opposite. Thucydides argues there is no history or writing unless it is completely rational. And so if someone tells me they met a god in the glade, well, they better prove it to me before I write it down. I'm not going to tell any of this. So what do you get? Ironically, you get Herodotus, who doesn't claim objectivity at all. He claims just the opposite. I'm just going to be as subjective as possible, tell all these stories. And ironically, it ends up sounding very truthful. Even when it's about goofy things like leprechauns running around a field, it's like, all right, something happened there. I'm not saying it was actually some sprite or fairy, but obviously this guy had an important experience. Whereas Thucydides, who will tell nothing but exactly what can be proven at any moment, well, he takes all the humanity out of humanity. There's nothing worth reading in here because unless he can prove it, he doesn't say it. And I understand there's a truthfulness in that, but in his truthfulness, he misses larger truths. And that's the irony of this, and something that I want all of us to think about. So I told you I'm just going to be Brad there for a moment. I'm not necessarily speaking as a Hillsdale professor, but as myself, 49-year-old, having been a historian my whole career, it strikes me as two very different ways of looking. And there is an irony that the subjectivist ends up being more objective, and the objectivist ends up being subjective. We have to kind of think about that, and why does it happen in that fashion? Okay, last thing I'm going to say today. What's the importance, or I'm going to ask actually, we've got just about 3 minutes left. What do you think the importance was of Herodotus writing down this dialogue? And remember, Herodotus doesn't question. He just writes it down. Here's a whole story. This whole story you have here is the story of Greek patriotism. The story of individuals saying no way to an empire. And then he turns around and out of this whole book, we assign you 3 pages of a number of goofy Persians, the enemy, talking with one another. What's the significance?
Well, the significance is they're talking about forms of government. And okay. The form of government is most just. And you were talking earlier about how the very reason Darius and Xerxes wanted to wipe the Greeks off the face of the earth is because they thought they were an offense to what at least Darius in this dialogue thought to be the primary form of government.
Okay, so let's talk about that, Scott. What's that mean? What does it mean that Persians are talking about forms of government? What is Herodotus trying to tell us? What matters in the world? Force of arms? What matters? Luke, what are these Persians doing? They've been introduced to free ideas. And now they're thinking like Greeks. Even though they're the invaders, they're the enemy, they're the bad guys, what Herodotus is telling us is, don't hide your freedom. Remember what Pericles says. Pericles says, even the enemies can come listen to me. We may be at war at you. Come on, come listen to me. Why? Because I'm teaching freedom. I don't care if you know who we are. We just told you who we are. We're free. There's no secrets. We're free and open. And that's exactly what Herodotus is saying here. He's making the point that of all peoples in the world, even the Persians can learn freedom. It's a natural thing. So that's his point here. But I want to point this out as well. And I'm sorry, this I'm being Brad again, but I love this figure. I love Otanes. You remember him? He's the one who says, you know what? I don't really like any of these forms of government. I'm going to go off and just do my own thing. I've got my own household. And what does Herodotus write? Yet to this day, they've left that guy and his family alone. He's just his own king. He's basically thumbed his nose at all forms of government. He's our first anarchist in Western civilization. And I kind of like him. You know, I'm not saying I'm promoting anarchy, but I do like the guy, right, quite a bit. Mary Kate.
I think it seems interesting, too, that there is a differentiation there between he has to obey the laws of the land, but
yes,
he doesn't have to obey the king.
Isn't that great?
The difference in authority there.
Absolutely, right? He's essentially his own authority as long as he follows the law of nature and the law of the land. Yeah, it's very great. Okay, thanks everyone. Great Monday. I know you're probably all tired, but it was great. We survived two tornadoes. Let's embellish that. We'll be here like Herodotus. All right. And so no new readings. Just make sure that you've read Pericles, the funeral oration for Wednesday. And we're going to go over it in pretty great detail. So if you're willing to read, please think about that, because I would love to have volunteers to read for that. All right. Thanks, everyone. God bless.